A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars, The New Jedi Order, The Unifying Force, by James Lucino, read for you by Jonathan Davis. It was raining insects on Yuuzhan Tar, the former Coruscant, once bright center, now dimmed, defiled by war, transformed by the Yuuzhan Vong into a riotous garden. To some, Yuuzhan Tar, creche of the gods, was a world returned to its bygone splendor, lost and rediscovered, more alive for having been conquered. Its orbit altered, tweaked sunward, three of its moons steered away and returned, and the fourth pulverized to form a braided ring, a bridge of supernatural light, along which the gods strolled in serene meditation. And yet insects were raining down on Supreme Overlord Shimra's rainbow-winged worldship Citadel, his holy mount rising from a Yorick coral cradle to tower over what had been the most populous and important precinct of the galactic capital. A kneeling gathering of priests, warriors, shapers, and intendants waited for the Supreme Overlord to speak.
"You are asking yourselves, where have we erred?"
Shimra said at last.
"Does the fault lie with our cleansings, our sacrifices, our conquests? Are we being tested by the gods, or have we been abandoned? Is Shimra still our conduit, or has he become our liability?"
Shimra paused to look around the hall, then asked,
"Do you think that your distrust in me, your whispered doubts, benefits our noble cause? If I can hear you, what must the gods be thinking when they look into each and every one of you? I will tell you what the gods are saying to another. They have lost faith in the one we set upon the Polyp throne, and in doubting the Supreme Overlord, our yoke to them, they doubt us. And so the gods visit plagues and defeats on their children, not to castigate me, but to demonstrate where you have failed, where you have failed them."
Below the Yorick coral throne sat his shamed familiar, Anami, part pet, part speaker of truths few dared to voice.
"You disgust me,"
Shimra told them.
"You think I'm spouting sacrilege. You recoil and grovel because you know that I speak the truth, and that truth rattles you to the core of your being. You'd do well to chop off more of yourselves in penance and devotion. Give all of yourselves, and it won't be enough."
He looked down at Anami.
"You think I speak in riddles, like this one?"
Anami's deformities owed not to birth, but to rejection by the gods. Once a shaper, he was now little more than a misshapen jester, one eye drooping below its mate, one yellow fang protruding from a twisted mouth, one portion of his skull distended, as if the shaper's Va tumor had failed to seat itself properly. Long and slender, his arms and legs twitched continuously, yanked about by the gods, as they might do to a puppet. Shimra's piercing gaze fell on War Master Nas Choka, noble in appearance despite his modest stature, with fine black hair combed straight back from his face and a wispy beard. Choka had been escalated in the wake of Savang La's death, but was not yet universally revered, despite his numerous victories in hot space.
"Learn from the mistakes of your precursors, War Master, and all will go well for you. Fail me as Domain Law did, and I will personally make an example of you that future War Masters will be forced to consider before they accept escalation."
Nas Choka inclined his head in a crisp bow and struck the points of his shoulders with the opposite fists. A Dovin basil cushion floated Shimra out of his throne to the ring of flower petals that encircled it, where he dismounted the cushion. Ankle-deep in the flowers, he raised his long-toothed scepter of rank.
All can be made right by the coming sacrifice, but we must take care against interference.
The heretics, August Lord, a priest said.
Shimra waved his empty hand in dismissal.
The heretics are nothing more than a pestilence, a plague of stink bugs we can eradicate at any time. I speak of interference from the unconverted, who move silently among us. Those who survive the planetary bombardment and world-shaping. The slaves who escaped the main seed ship that delivered the world brain to Yuuzhan'tar. The resistance fighters who profane our holy ground. And the Jedi.
As if on cue, Anami scrambled to his feet and followed Shimra along the flowered ring, reciting,
The shamed are naught but nuisance flies, at least as seen through Shimra's eyes. The Jedi are the ones he mourns, edged and sharp as Senelac thorns.
When Shimra swung about, Anami bowed in mock gallantry. One of the spotlessly adorned shapers rose and hastened from the hall. Moments later, entering through both the priest and warrior portals, marched a group of 10 males. Shorter even than Nas Choka, they carried restless amphistaffs and wetted kufis. Steng's talons sprouted from their robust bodies, which were smeared black with dried blood. The 10 were unlike the special breed of warriors known as hunters, who were privileged to sport the photosensitive mimetic cloak of Nu'un. But something new and disconcerting. And the female seers were the first to voice their dismay.
What desecration is this? Armed as warriors, yet clothed as attendants to the gods. What shaper is responsible?
Anami gambled over to them and adopted a haughty posture.
To prove the force a farce indeed, Shimra's will the shaper's heed. Birthing troops of mingled caste, great Nas Choka, they will outlast.
One of the seers made a futile grab for Anami, while the others continued to shout dire warnings.
No shaper other than myself is responsible,
Shimra said, silencing them.
By my injunction do these warriors come to be. Our Jedi. Charged with guarding the life of your supreme overlord, as well as with rooting out our enemies and exterminating them. At their disposal, they will have Goroskippers of unique design, with advanced weaponry, and the ability to travel through dark space unassisted.
Shimra paused, then added,
They shall be called Slayers, in honor of Yun Yamka. Lest he feel uncomfortable about mingling with priests.
They have the look of shamed ones.
Shimra whirled on the warrior who said it.
Shamed, you say? By my mandate were they created, Supreme Commander Cha'an. By divine edict. If the gods have disapproved, would these warriors not bear the markings of pariahs?
Supreme Commander Cha'an stood his ground.
Shamed one shaped to resemble those who have been embraced by the gods, great lord. Concealing the deformities that would signal their unworthiness. Is it too much to ask that we be shown proof of their status?
Shimra grinned diabolically.
Cursed you are by your own request, Commander. Step forward with 10 of your warriors and do your best against these.
Cha'an snapped his fist to his shoulders and summoned 10 warriors to their feet. Kufis, shields, tridents and amphistaffs woke to the challenge. At the same time, the warrior priests spread out, but only 2 stepped forward.
2 against 11, Cha'an said in sudden consternation. This is vulgar. Dishonor either way.
Shimra returned to his throne and sat.
Then we will be pleased to see you humble them, if only to demonstrate that our shapers have failed in their task. carve them, Commander, as a dish fit for the gods.
Sha'an saluted crisply. At his curt nod, the 10 warriors attacked, two groups of four moving to outflank their opponents, and the remaining two rushing forward immediately to engage and distract. The reactions of the warrior priests were almost too fast to follow. They turned slightly to the side, almost back to back, wielding weapons in both hands, meeting the frontal attack and the flanking attack simultaneously. The amphistaffs of the attackers struck seemingly unarmored flesh without finding purchase. Kufis cut and sliced, and yet almost no blood flowed. What little did, congealed instantly. The melee weapons of the defenders were no less enhanced than were the small, muscular warrior priests who wielded them. The specially bred amphistaffs snapped the heads off their lesser cousins and stabbed with enough force to paralyze even through armor. One by one and sliced to pieces, Cha'an's warriors dropped to the floor. Silence gripped the hall as the elite of all castes watched with a mix of awe and dread. Shimra was already powerful enough without this royal guard. Now he was no match for any domain that might think to thwart him. The fight was over almost as quickly as it began, with the 10 warriors and Cha'an felled and bleeding, and the two warrior priests unmoved by what they had done, their slender amphistaffs badged with blood. The shaper who had escorted the group into the hall stepped forward to appraise the warriors and address Shimra.
Our Talar warriors kept rejecting the implants. The faster metabolic rate of our shorter warriors is better suited to the rapid cellular activity of the implant biots.
Onami scampered over to one of the dead warriors and prodded him.
Most impressive. Done with flair. But against the Jedi, how will they fare?
Shimra nodded to Master Shaper Kila Quad.
Show him.
Few members of the elite were as fearsome to gaze upon as Kila Quad, but the object she held in her eight-fingered cephalopod hand made her writhing snake's headdress and bulging cranium seem positively ordinary.
The weapon of the Jedi!
One of the warriors shouted.
More sacrilege, another said.
Hold your tongues or forfeit them,
Shimra snapped.
This is the energy blade taken from the Jedi who killed you in great numbers in the Well of the World Brain. The one whom so many of you hold in reverence. Ganner. Think of the blade not as an abomination then, but a holy relic of that warrior's might.
Moving directly to one of the slayers, Kila Quad ignited the lightsaber, raised it to her opposite shoulder, and with a slashing motion, drew the violet blade diagonally across the slayer's chest. The smell of burned flesh wafted through the hall. Shimra turned slightly to face the commanders.
Only a furrow where any one of you would lie in two pieces on the floor.
They are more Von Dun Crab than Yuuzhan Vong,
High Priest Jaqen muttered.
Shimra seethed.
Von Dun Crab, Dovin Basil Yamask warrior. Need I remind you of all people that we are all grown from the same seed?
Nomanor. Slightly taller than the average human, disfigured by ceremony and by his own hand, fitted with a false eye that could spit poison, waited uneasily at the entry to Shimra's private chambers in the rounded crown of the Sacred Mountain. He hadn't been summoned to private audience with the Supreme Overlord since his return from Zonama Seacot, and he wasn't sure what to expect. The membrane shimmered and parted to reveal Onami, gesticulating to Nomanor.
Enter, Prefect,
Shimra's pet said, affecting a supercilious tone. Nomanor edged past him into the spacious circular chamber. Shimra sat in the center of the room, atop a circular dais, in a high-backed seat that lacked the pomp of his public throne.
Did you not wonder when we three would meet again?
Onami asked softly as Nomanor passed. Nomanor ignored the question and approached the throne, genuflecting at the edge of the foul-smelling moat. From an inner pocket of his green robe, he removed the lightsaber that had stirred so much strife in the Hall of Confluence earlier on.
Dreadlord, your desire was that this be delivered to you.
Nomanor kept his gaze lowered while Shimra took the weapon from his hand. He looked up with alarm when he heard the distinctive snap hiss of the lightsaber's energy blade. No larger than a votive candle in the grip of Shimra's right hand, the lightsaber thrummed as it cleaved the air.
Answer me honestly, Prefect. Do you believe in the gods?
Shimra brought the violet blade close to Nomanor's neck.
Bear in mind, honestly, if there was some benefit to believing, you mean. I follow the example set by the priests, Lord.
Shimra's eyes bored into Nomanor's single orb.
Are you suggesting, Prefect, that our priests are not acting out of the goodness of their hearts?
Lord, I have seen many hearts, and few showed evidence of goodness.
Clever,
Shimra said slowly.
That's the word everyone who knows you, or who has had dealings with you, uses. Clever.
To Nomanor's relief, Shimra deactivated the lightsaber.
What does one like yourself make of the whisperings that circulate among the elite?
Shimra asked from his simple chair.
That the gods have become angered by my decisions.
May I speak freely, Lord?
You had better,
Anami said. Shimra glanced from Anami to Nomanor, then nodded his enormous head.
I would answer that many of the high caste failed to grasp that the actions you took were a tribute to the gods. Actions no less bold than those taken by Yun Yuzhan when he gave of himself to bring the universe into being.
Shimra leaned forward.
You impress me, Prefect. Continue.
Nomanor grew more confident. Many of us had accepted as fact that the generations of wandering through the intergalactic void had been a test of faith, which, as you yourself pointed out, we failed miserably. By quarreling among ourselves and worshipping false gods, weakening the hinges of our own gates. Shimra nodded sagely.
Any group without opposition falls inexorably into decay and tyranny, or both.
But you, Dreadlord, saw the arduous journey for what it was. A consequence of our previous failures. You understood that our shapers were fast approaching the limits of traditional knowledge. That they were essentially powerless to repair our deteriorating worldships. That our priests were likewise unable to rescue our society from the depths to which it had sunk. That our warriors, left without a war, had nowhere to turn but upon one another. We were dying in the void, Lord, and were it not for your toppling of Quoriel and his cautious followers, the Yuuzhan Vong might have ended there.
Shimra stared at him.
Oh, you are a dangerous person, Prefect.
He paused, then added,
I will educate you about the gods. The question is not whether they exist, but if we have any further need of them. The gods may have created us, but it is we who sustain them through worship. Now, they are bereft because the roles are reversed. They are angry because they have been forced to recognize that their hour has arrived. That the time has come to surrender power to Shimra and the New Order.
Again, Shimra ignited the lightsaber and waved it about, as if to emphasize his remarks.
This is the Great Har War, Prefect. The Yuuzhan Vong against the gods.
Luke and Mara Jade Skywalker stood in the trapezoidal entrance to the cliff dwelling that had been their home and shelter on Zonama Seacot for what had felt like 3 standard weeks. Torrential rain continued to lash the middle distance, driven by gales powerful enough to snap and topple the giant boras and strip the reddish trees of their globular leaves. Caught in an updraft, three sheets of lamina building material spiraled up from the floor of the chasm and disappeared over the rim. "This place is coming apart," Mara said. Luke nodded, but said nothing. To Luke's left stood R2-D2. Luke put his left hand on the astromech droid's hemispherical head. "Don't worry, R2. We'll come through this all right." R2 swiveled his primary photoreceptor to Luke. "Corrin is coming," Luke announced in a matter-of-fact tone. Mara slipped out of his embrace and leaned out the entrance to gaze around, one hand clasping her long hair. "Where?" she said, just loudly enough to be heard. "I don't see." She interrupted herself when she saw his head poke above the rungs of a wooden ladder that rose from a lower tier. Soaked to the bone, Corrin held his jacket closed at the neck. "Jason and Sava's airship has been spotted down valley," he shouted into the wind. "They should arrive any minute." Luke stepped out into the rain and wind to glance at the landing platform that jutted out over the canyon. He looked back at R2, who was whining in apprehension. "Stay here, R2. We'll be right back." The three Jedi hurried for the ladder. Corrin was only steps behind when they reached the platform itself, square and cantilevered by thick timbers anchored in the cliff face. From down valley, and drifting to and fro in the wind, appeared a cluster of what might have been balloons, holding aloft an oblong wooden gondola with an aft cabin. "There she blows," Corrin said. "You're not kidding," Mara said. She looked at Luke. "They'll never be able to land." "They will. They have the Force at their backs." Luke set himself in the near-horizontal rain and focused his attention on the approaching airship. Through the Force, he could feel Mara and Corrin join him, and he could also feel the tremendous power Jason and Saba were exercising to prevent the airship from being blown where the howling wind wanted to take it. Confidence surged through him. The Jedi were working not against the natural forces, but in harmony with them, availing themselves of just those gusts that would maneuver the airship to the destination they had chosen. Had there been better forewarning of the trap the three Yuuzhan Vong agents had sprung, Seacott also might have been able to maneuver Zonama through hyperspace to a safe landing. But the jump to light speed had been inadvertent, though fortunately in place of the planned destruction of the planet. When Zonama Seacott first emerged from transit, conditions were even worse than those that followed. Luke could remember staring into an unfamiliar night sky. Then, at daybreak, an enormous sun ballooning on the horizon like an explosion, too brilliant to regard, and radiating such heat that huge expanses of Tampasi had burst into flame. Seismic events had opened yawning, zigzagging fissures on the high plateaus, and gigantic slabs of rock had been thrust from the parted ground. Forest fires filled the already scorching air with smoke, cinder, and ash. Whether because of further misfortune or at Seacott's direction, none could say. But rain had been falling ever since. Under the guidance of the five Jedi, the airship completed its descent and made a satisfactory landing on the platform. Luke, Mara, and Corrin had the ship tethered to its docking cleats even before Jason and Saba emerged from the small cabin. "Welcome back," Luke said, clapping his nephew on the shoulders, then hugging him. R2-D2 was chirping in excitement when the waterlogged Jedi filed through the trapezoidal entrance. A nourishing fire blazed in the center of the room, smoke escaping through a natural chimney. Luke took off his wet cloak and hung it by the fire, then sat down opposite Jason and Saba. "Tell us everything." With a nod of her round head, Saba deferred to Jason. "Conditions in the south are worse than here," the young man began. "The forests are scorched beyond recognition. The trails are impassable, and the rivers are too swollen to navigate. A lot of the boras are completely leafless, and the wildlife has been shocked into hibernation. Most of the Faroans reached the shelters in time, but hundreds died. Cybernetic organisms bred by the planet's early magisters, overseers, and liaisons with Seacott, the Gentari were the carvers and assemblers of Zonama's once-celebrated living starships.
Some Faroans are saying that the southern hemisphere is every bit as traumatized as it was when the Far Outsiders attacked, Jason continued. Far Outsiders was the Faroan term for the Yuuzhan Vong, who had found and engaged Onamasikot some 50 years earlier, when first scouting the galaxy they planned to invade. Luke studied his hands and shook his head back and forth. Has anyone seen Jabatha?
Not since the days Onama caught fire,
Saba replied. Seacott's humanoid interface with its sentient residents, Jabatha, was Onama's current magister, the third in the planet's history. During her brief appearance following the planet's emergence from hyperspace, Jabatha had said only that Seacott had desperate need of her elsewhere, and that she would return when she could. Present at the appearance, Luke and the other Jedi had quickly discerned that the Jabatha who spoke to them was merely a thought projection of Seacott. That fact had been borne out later, when Jabatha's entranced body had been discovered in her dwelling place. In front of the hearth, an apparition appeared, gradually manifesting as a tall, wide-eyed, dark-haired, and faintly blue-skinned woman, wearing a black robe decorated with green medallions that sparkled in the light of the fire. Jabatha, Luke said, coming to his feet. Of a sort, Mara said quietly as she joined him.
Seacott wishes to reassure you that Zonama will persevere,
the thought-projected Jabatha said without preamble.
Since perseverance will necessitate significant alterations to Zonama's present orbit and spin, it would be best if everyone remained in the shelters for the time being.
Luke drew in his breath, only to sense that his relief was premature.
I am also charged with advising you that Seacott needs time to reassess the possible consequences of returning Zonama to known space. As caretaker of the living force, the continued existence of Zonama Seacott is of utmost importance. Seacott has some idea where we are, Jabatha was saying. It's possible that Zonama Seacott passed close to the star system during the crossings from known space.
Luke motioned across the room to R2-D2, who was standing silently against the wall. Tell Seacott that R2 can help compute the location, as soon as we can see the stars.
I will tell Seacott, Jabatha said, dematerializing.
The five Jedi had yet to emerge from reflection when someone hurried out of the storm into the dwelling's anteroom.
Danny,
Luke said, even as he was turning toward her. Danny Kui's blonde hair hung loosely around her face, but her green eyes shone with excitement.
Tekli and Tahiri,
she said in a rush. Mara shot to her feet.
What's happened?
Danny motioned behind her, as if to something just outside the entrance.
They're with him now! The Yuuzhan Vong priest! Harar!
She blinked and stared at Mara and the others.
He's alive!
Twin Sun Squadron, of battle-seasoned X-Wings, emerged from hiding with wingtip lasers charged and stabilizers locked in attack position. The convoy of pod-shaped Peace Brigade freighters and their escort of war vessels was strung out in a long line that trailed past Sylvaris's moon almost to the planet itself. Ensconced in Twin Suns 1, Jaina Solo flew point for the three squadrons under her command. Gloved hands gripped on the X-Wing's control stick, she chinned her helmet comm. All flights, form up on your leaders and keep your battle channels open for instructions. Scimitar leader, do you copy?
Copy, Twin One,
Colonel Ijix Harona said. Yellow Tanab leader, do you copy? Wes Jansen comm back.
Loud and clear, Twin One.
The X-Wing sensors painted blue and yellow bezels on the cockpit displays. Scimitar leader, your squadron has the number one carrier. Tanab leader, those forward gunships are yours. Twin Suns will take the carrier umbilical to the brigade freighter. The rest of the convoy vessels are designated to Dozen, Black Moon, and Vanguard fighter squadrons. Named by Luke Skywalker for his double-starred homeworld of Tatooine, Twin Suns was made up of T-65A2s and XJ-3 X-Wings. Ijix Harona's scimitars were wedge-shaped A-Wings, Black Moon was E-Wings, and the Tanab Aces, a volunteer squadron, were yellow snub fighters adorned with black stripes. The Dozen had originally been formed by Kip Durin, the Vanguard by Jagged Fell and his Chiss comrades. Where's Jag? Colonel Fell? Jaina asked Kip. I thought the Chiss were going to participate.
Vanguard was held back in Mon Calamari, Kip said. Something big is brewing.
He sends his love, the Jedi Master added. The sending caught Jaina by surprise, and her face took on sudden color. From its socket behind the X-Wing's canopy, Jaina's R2-B3 unit, Cappy, relayed an urgent message to the cockpit. She studied the translation display screen and chinned her comm again. All pilots, sensors are showing intensifying hyperdrive emissions in the Peace Brigade freighters.
Copy, Twin One,
Harona said.
They're ramping up to make the jump to light speed.
Jaina reached for the throttle. They're not leaving without our permission. All flights, move in to intercept and obstruct. Jaina watched Peace Brigade ships break formation, the lead freighters veering to either side, and midline vessels angling for cover behind Sylvaris' moon. Elements of Kip's Dozen and Black Moon swept in to cut off the enemy ships. Jaina pulled back on the yoke and sent her craft into a predatory bank that would have knocked the wind from her in atmosphere. But here, with the inertial compensators enabled, felt like nothing more than a slow glide. Laser beams and molten projectiles streaked from the convoy escort ships, tearing into the ranks of starfighters. Two X-Wings disappeared in globular explosions. Some of the Peace Brigade ships were faster than they looked. Thrusters blazing, they raced rimward, even with Black Moon and Scimitar starfighters hanging on their tails, raking fire across their hulls and engine nacelles. But the pursuit was ill-timed.
I count 1, 2, 3 brigade ships away,
Harona said as the freighters made the jump to hyperspace and vanished.
Should we go after them?
Negative, Jaina said quickly. Their orders were to rescue as many prisoners as possible, not chase the enemy clear to Coruscant. Just make sure no others get past us. Kip's Dozen hurtled forward to make sure that none did, paying out concussion missiles and torpedoes as necessary to corral the fleeing freighters. Jaina slew to starboard, in time to see the enemy fighters drop from the undersides of their carriers and form up in clouds around the remaining freighters and Yuuzhan Vong gunships. One flight, she said. Change to course 101 ecliptic. Set lasers for out-of-phase fire. Remember to toggle your grab safeties if Dovin Basals pull your shields. Lobaka and Alima touched her briefly through the Force, as their separate four-fighter contingents altered vectors accordingly and began to accelerate toward the tethered carrier. Make every shot count, she said. Reserve torpedoes and concussion missiles for the carrier. An organic-looking cofferdam still linked the Yuuzhan Vong vessel to a Peace Brigade freighter. Between Twin Suns and the leased ships, local space was target-rich with coral skippers. The X-Wing sensor screens grew noisy with battle static as bursts of green, coherent light streaked from the starfighters' weapons. At the end of the first run, Jaina powered Twin Suns 1 through a tight turn, accelerated, and rocketed back into the thick of the fighting. Superheated ejecta surged from the coral skipper's volcano-like launchers, whipping past her canopy like fiery meteors. She wreathed through a tight grouping of enemy fighters, responding in kind. One skip scudded clear of her carefully timed bursts, but a second, she caught off guard with steady fire, destroying it completely. Peeling away from the fireball, Jaina prowled for new targets. The battle channels were noisy with chatter.
We can't clear a path for the transport with those skips hugging the carriers.
Harona was admonishing Scimitar Squadron.
Three flight, you've got to take out that dorsal plasma launcher. Two flight, see if you can draw those skips away. We're trying, Scimitar Leader, but they won't take the bait. Copy that. Then we'll just have to take the fight to them.
Jaina saw that the same situation applied to the tethered carrier. The coral skippers were intent on protecting the vessel at all costs, or at least until it could detach from the Peace Brigade freighter. Jaina wheeled away from a flurry of missiles, rolled, and came about. She and the opposing flight leader squared off and bored in on each other, their respective wingmates falling back, too busy holding position and adapting to their leader's actions to do any firing. The skip opened a void directly in front of Jaina, but she managed to twist free in the nick of time. The X-Wing bucked, then righted itself. Jaina thumbed the trigger of the lasers, pouring fire into the gravitic hole. The Dovin Basal rushed to absorb the energy, leaving the coral skipper momentarily unprotected. It was all the time Jaina needed. The X-Wing's starboard lasers hammer the skip mercilessly, splitting it down the middle. Long plumes of incandescence stream from the rend. Then the skip vanished in blinding light. Two and three flights were meeting with similar success. Kip Com Jaina.
Just learned that Alliance agents have sabotaged the hyperdrives on all but one of the freighters. They're ours now.
That's great news, Jaina said.
Here's an even better piece. Your parents are here.
Jaina smiled. I felt them. Her eyes followed a blip on the display screen that could only be the Millennium Falcon. It was headed her way. She sent a greeting through the Force. Her mother would know who it was from. It wasn't long before she could see the Falcon with her own eyes. Her parents were maneuvering the ship as deftly as if she were an X or Y-wing, top and belly quad lasers dispatching coral skippers unlucky enough to be in the way. A sleek Alliance picket, bristling with weapons, flew in the Falcon's wake. As the two ships closed on the number two carrier, the picket fired a harpoon directly into the nose of the Peace Brigade freighter at the other end of the carrier's intestine-like cofferdam.
Knockout harpoon,
Twin Sons 4 said.
Like a giant hypodermic syringe filled with coma gas. By the time our people board, the Brigaders will be out cold.
Transparent respirators clamped over their faces, and C-3PO shuffling behind them. Han and Leia emerged from the crippled freighter's docking bay into the large cargo hold beyond. Everywhere they looked, Peace Brigaders of various species were passed out on the deck, or slumped, unmoving against bulkheads. Han and Leia scarcely had time to take stock of the situation when a hatch in the forward bulkhead pocketed itself, and a Klatooinian stepped into the hold. 20 blaster rifles swung to the green-complected, scrunch-faced humanoid before he could so much as raise his taloned hands in surrender.
"I'm Hobio," he said.
A breather mask dangled around his thick neck.
"The one who sabotaged the hyperdrive! Surprise party!"
A human colonel signaled everyone to lower their weapons. "Next time, give the code words first, before you come barging into a secured area," he snapped. "You're lucky you didn't get yourself killed." Hobio relaxed somewhat.
"You won't find any prisoners aboard the freighter. They were transferred to the Yuuzhan Vong carrier."
"Which way?" the colonel demanded. The Klatooinian pointed to port.
"The umbilical is attached to the cargo hold adjacent this one."
Han motioned with his chin to the passageway. "You coming?"
"As soon as I provide identities of the Peace Brigaders."
Han nodded and waved to C-3PO. "Let's go, Goldenrod." The droid started.
"Sir, wouldn't it be best if I remained aboard the Millennium Falcon?"
"Cac-Mame and Meewal can take care of the Falcon. We might need you to translate." Han and Leia led the way into the portside cargo hold. Han spied the cofferdam entrance and ran for it, only to stop short at the mouth, then half-turn and flatten his back against the bulkhead. "You really don't want to see this," he said as Leia approached. She studied him in puzzlement. "Remember that time on Dantooine when I got the Balmora flu? Well, this thing," Han jerked his thumb toward the cofferdam opening, "is what I figure the inside of my nose must have looked like." Leia smiled dubiously and stepped around him. "It can't be that bad." She froze.
"Why, it's an Oka,"
C-3PO said, standing somewhat akimbo at the entrance.
"The word derived from the proboscis of a Yuuzhan Vong pack animal. The floor is what is sometimes referred to as a microbial mat, and the viscous liquid drooling from the ceiling actually houses the bacteria that engineered the entire tube."
"I told you he'd come in handy," Han said. C-3PO disappeared into the organic cofferdam, sloshing along the puddle floor. They covered the 100 meters in record time, eyes forward and arms straight at their sides. They could tell which way the strike troops had gone by the gaping holes the soldiers had blown in membranous interior bulkheads and iris portals. Leia ignited her lightsaber. From ships forward came the sounds of war cries and muffled shouts, blaster fire, and the dull thudding of amphistaff strikes. They sprinted toward the sounds of battle, rounding a corner to see allies and enemies down, smears of red and black on the floor, refreshment for a host of tongue-like creatures that were gorging on the spilled blood. Han shot from the hip, dropping a Yuuzhan Vong warrior with a kufi dagger in each hand. With a downward slash, Leia cut the legs out from under another, who had launched himself at her. They followed the strike troops farther forward. The soldiers held their blasters at high port, sweeping them from side to side. Stepping over sprawled bodies, Han, Leia, and a squad of troops reached another intersection. The squad leader was trying to decide which fork to take when Hobyo finally caught up with them.
The prisoners are on the upper deck, in a hold after the command chamber.
The Klaatu-inian edged his way into the intersection and gestured.
This way.
A steeply sloped corridor led up to the carrier's command deck. At the top of the slope, two strike troops had a peace brigader in custody. A strong smell of glitterstim spice wafted from the human's uniform. The brigader led the rest of the way to the forward hold. There, squashed together inside a sticky net, sat three Yuuzhan Vong. One wore a command cloak that hung from bony implants on the tops of his shoulders. The strike troop's colonel was circling them proudly, with his hands planted on his hips, thumbs backward. Across the hold, 50 or so Alliance prisoners of various species were stuck to the deck in a pool of Blorash jelly.
Han! Leia!
One of them called out. The speaker was a thick-set human, with pleasant, if undistinguished, features and a full salt-and-pepper beard. Judder Page, Han said, grinning as he approached. He scanned other faces in the crowd. And Pash! Kraken nodded his head in greeting. Rescued by celebrities. I'm positively humbled. Leia studied the Blorash jelly. We need to get you out of this. A strike troop officer hurried into the hold.
Enemy reinforcements coming out of hyperspace. We need to move.
In a mad dance, Jaina circled the stricken Yuuzhan Vong carrier, dueling coral skippers with each dive and traverse. The battle roles had been reversed. Now starfighter squadrons were the defenders, and skips the aggressors, surging forward to harry and engage at every opportunity.
Heads up, she said over the battle channel. Vessels decanting from hyperspace.
They appear to be coral skippers,
Perona said.
Approaching from starboard of Selvaris. I make it three stacked triangles of six skips.
Jaina shook her head. Coral skippers lack the ability to travel through hyperspace unassisted. Scimitar leader, that can't be right.
Twin Suns one,
Wes Jansen said.
These blips don't match anything in the battle log.
What the long-range scanner showed made her sit up straighter in the X-Wing's contoured seat. The fighters, if indeed that was what they were made up of three Yorick coral triangles joined apex to base. The leading two triangles showed mica-like canopies, while the third and largest was flared at the rear and sported a long upcurving tail, perhaps to augment Dovin basal impulsion, which in a coral skipper was often located in the nose. From the forward segments of the scaled fuselage sprouted six legs, three pairs to each side, veined in blue, and tipped with launcher ports for plasma missiles.
Enemy is breaking formation,
Perona announced.
Here they come!
The formations of snarling skips surged forward with incredible speed, their sextets of launchers disgorging plasma in steady streams. Deliberately, Jaina placed herself in the path of one projectile and was immediately sorry she had. Cappy shrieked in distress, and the X-Wing's shields fell to 50%. She tumbled away from second and third projectiles, allowing time for the shields to recharge. All pilots keep clear of these things. They pack a wallop. The warning did not come soon enough. The battle net grew frantic with exclamations.
Twin 6 and 7 are down! Scimitar reporting 4 casualties. To Nab 10, pull out! Divert power to your shields!
Jaina glanced over her right shoulder and saw Twin Suns 2 fly apart. This can't be happening, she thought. Twisting free of engagements, four enemy fighters converged on the Falcon. Jaina tried to establish contact with her parents, but the battle channel was screeching with static. Mom! The Falcon was jarred by missiles her parents either hadn't seen coming or were unable to avoid. In her mind's eye, Jaina could see Han taking the ship through a repertoire of evasive maneuvers. And yet, the enemy pilots of the Stingcrawler skips were clearly anticipating the Falcon's every move. Jaina, Alima, and Twin 11 and 12 flew to the freighter's rescue, battering the skip from behind. but the Yuuzhan Vong fighters refused to be distracted from their target. In a moment of blind rage, Jaina dropped her guard and was struck from starboard. Slewing helplessly, she watched 11 and 12 shatter. The enemy was on a killing spree. Jaina flinched with each magma missile that hit the Falcon. The freighter's shields were holding, but the Falcon was literally rattling around inside them. The Falcon and the gunship were almost clear enough to go to hyperspace. Jaina imagined herself in the outrigger cockpit, throwing switches and actuators, pushing the hyperspace lever forward. The sometimes unreliable navicomputer counting down before the ship could make the jump to light speed. Hurry, she said to herself. Hurry! The detonation nearly threw Leia out of her seat harness. Han's hands were white-knuckled on the yoke. Cinched into the cockpit's high-backed rear chairs, Kraken and Paige extended their arms to keep themselves upright. The other rescued officers were packed into the forward cabin and wherever else they could fit.
How much more of this can the Falcon take?
Paige asked.
As much as she needs to,
Han growled, without meaning to. Han sent the Falcon on edge to evade a trio of enemy ships, escaping with only a bone-rattling hip to the freighter's midsection. The cockpit turned blinding white. A wave of concussive sound barreled into the cockpit through the sliding hatch, and Leia's ears popped.
Oh.
C-3PO let out a wail from somewhere aft. Shields are down to 40%, she said when she could. Han could scarcely hear her. He reached over his left shoulder, his hand knowing precisely where to go, like that of a musician at a keyboard. Finished with whatever adjustments he had made, he smiled for show. Leia heard him mumble,
Come on, baby, hold together just 20 seconds more.
The Falcon took her worst hit yet. A tangle of blue energy danced over the navicomputer. A single rivulet of sweat coursed from Han's hairline to his set jaw. Leia faced forward, staring straight ahead. Now I'm worried. Without looking at her, Han counted down. 10, 9, 8. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3 was on the tip of Jaina's tongue when the Falcon was hit hard from behind, the force of the enemy projectiles practically kicking the freighter forward. Then, the Falcon was gone, propelled into hyperspace, but with four enemy skips following suit. All pilots, did anyone get a bearing on the Falcon?
Negative, Twin One,
came a chorus of replies. The operation rally point was Mon Calamari. But Jaina recognized that the Falcon's jump to light speed had been desperate, and she doubted that the navicomputer had had time enough to plot an accurate trajectory. There were thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of possible hyperspace exit points between Selvaris and Mon Calamari. Twin sons, fall back to protect the transports, she said when she had gotten hold of herself. We're taking them home. Single file, Luke, Mara, Corrin, Jason, and Saba trailed Danny Quee down into the canyon, where they hoped to find the Yuuzhan Vong priest, Harar. They were 20 meters from the dwelling when a group of 8 Faroan males stepped from the gloom of a natural cave to intercept them. In his left hand, their apparent leader, Senshi, held a glow stick that cast off a misty sphere of light around them.
You captured a Yuuzhan Vong,
he said, breath clouds accompanying his words. Luke shook his head. He was found wounded and brought here to be healed.
Not wounded by any of us, Senshi said,
though deserving of whatever injuries he sustained, for what he and the others caused to happen.
We don't know yet who or what was responsible, Luke said. We're hoping the priest will explain. He advanced a step, but no one in the group moved. The Faroan gestured toward the cliff dwelling.
As an enemy of Zonama Seacott, the Yuuzhan Vong should be ours to deal with.
Give us a chance to talk with him before you decide on a course of action, Luke said after a moment. The Faroans mulled over Luke's proposal.
Only if one of us is present.
Senshi answered for all of them. Which of you? Luke asked, glancing at everyone. A young man with white hair stepped forward.
I will go. I am called Maeda.
Luke nodded. then it's decided. Luke and the rest came out of the rain to find Harar seated on the floor by the hearth, his long legs stretched out in front of him. Tekle stood to one side, ministering to his injuries. Tahiri was about to introduce Luke and the others when Harar cut her off with a motion of his hand.
I will speak to them in your tongue.
His drooping eyes darted briefly to Tahiri. Luke regarded the priest for a long moment, then said, I am Luke Skywalker. This is my wife, Mara. Harar's eyes lit up in obvious recognition of the names. Luke continued, You've already met Tahiri and Corrin, and by now Tekle and Danny. He gestured to his right. That leaves only Saba, Jason, and Maida, whose world you obviously came to destroy.
Jason Solo,
Harar said, in what might almost have been taken for awe.
I have observed you from afar, young Jedi, figuratively and literally.
Luke tucked his hands into the sleeves of his cloak and sat down opposite Harar on a short-legged stool. You seem to know more about us than we know about you. Perhaps you're willing to correct that.
Perhaps.
The rest of the Jedi and Maida sat down in a loose semicircle. You told Corrin and Tahiri that you, Nen Yim, and the Prophet were seeking answers from Zonama Sikat. Nothing more. Harar nodded.
We kept to ourselves that each of us had a separate agenda.
He paused briefly.
Nen Yim was a Shapar, at one time apprentice to Mijan Quad, who attempted to remake Tahiri into one of us on the world you know as Yavin 4. Shimra had tasked Nen Yim to analyze an organic ship that was grown here on Zonama Sikot. In doing so, she made a remarkable discovery that appears in many ways to link this world with the Yuuzhan Vong. She came here seeking verification of her theories. As for Yu Sha, the prophet, well, his alleged reason for accompanying us was to determine if Zonama Sikot could be of some use to the heretical movement he helped organize among the Shamed Ones on Yuuzhan Tar.
And your reason? Mara asked.
Of less noble principle, Harar said. I suspected that Shapar Nen Yim was also a heretic, though of a different order. I suspected further that Shimra was aware of her unorthodox practices, which meant that he too was a heretic. Finally, I was interested in unmasking Yusha, and in determining whether or not he was genuine in his beliefs.
The prophet killed Nen Yim and left you for dead, Luke said. Was that because you and Nen Yim succeeded in unmasking him?
No. His purpose was to make certain that we didn't survive to share in the glory of destroying Zonama Sikot.
Harar looked at Luke.
As it happens, you know him.
Luke waited.
He is none other than Nom Anor.
It was nothing Luke hadn't already heard from Corrin and Tahiri, but had wanted to hear it from the priest. We know that, Mara said, but something isn't right. Nom Anor may have come here masquerading as the prophet, but I can't accept that Nom Anor is the one who has been influencing the Shamed Ones to place their faith in the Jedi.
I confess to being astonished as well, Harar said. But you must understand, because of what happened at Ibak 9, Nom Anor had little option but to place himself as far as possible from Shimra's reach, which is not an easy thing to do. In Yuuzhan Tar's underground places, Nom Anor probably fell in with the heretics, and gradually saw some advantage to becoming their chief instigator and voice.
Now that doesn't surprise me, Mara said. But he must have realized that Zonama Sikot can provide an end to the war, Luke said. So why attempt to destroy it when his followers stood to gain the most? Harar shook his head.
I can only speculate. Perhaps his actions here have enabled him to re-ingratiate himself with Shimra,
for Shimra fears this world more than you know. It has always been Nom Anor's desire to be escalated, and the possibility of escalation may have been reason enough for him to forsake the heretics who placed their trust in him. It's also plausible that Nomanor has been working secretly for Shimra all the while, even as the Prophet. Shimra may have wished to create a perceived problem on Yuuzhan'tar to distract the elite from more pressing problems regarding the war and the rebellious nature of Yuuzhan'tar's world brain. Or he may have planned to use the growing heresy as justification for ridding our society of undesirables and pariahs. Harar sighed with purpose. Nomanor is a consummate infidel. He thinks only of his own ambitions. He glanced around the small room, but it appears that he was unsuccessful in eliminating Zonama Seacott as a potential threat to his and Shimra's plans.
That remains to be seen, Corin said. Either as a result of Nomanor's actions, or as a way of protecting itself, Zonama Seacott jumped into hyperspace. To where, we've yet to learn. Maybe deeper into the unknown regions, maybe closer to known space. If this rain ever stops, we may be able to figure out where we are. But so far, Seacott hasn't seemed fit to help us.
Seacott,
Harar repeated. Zonama's guiding intelligence, Jason said. The priest fell silent for a long moment, then said,
Answer one question for me. Can Zonama Seacott help you defeat us? Is it indeed a weapon?
Luke touched his jaw. It has that capability. Harar exhaled slowly and sadly.
Then no wonder Shimra fears it so. It is as prophesied.
He looked questioningly at Luke.
Will you kill me now? Sacrifice me to the Force?
That's not our way, Luke said. Harar's initial confusion gave way to resolution.
Then if you would allow me, I wish to help bring about a resolution between your varied species and mine. We must at least attempt to mark a new beginning.
We're going to come out of this in one piece? Judder Page asked as Han was returning to the cockpit.
In the adjacent chair, Pash Kraken repressed a smile. The Millennium Falcon had been in hyperspace for just under 5 standard hours, most of which Han had spent elsewhere in the freighter, evaluating the extent of the damage and checking on the passengers who were crammed into every available cabin space. Han looked from Page to Kraken to Leia, who had remained in the co-pilot's chair throughout the lightspeed transit.
Didn't you tell them everything would be fine?
She shrugged. Maybe they don't trust me. Han strapped into the pilot's chair and swiveled to the two Alliance officers.
Unless we took a wrong turn at the last nebula, we should be coming up on Kalula any minute now.
Leia stared at him. Kalula? In the T in Hegemony? Could you have picked a more out-of-the-way planet?
Coming out of hyperspace, Han interrupted, reaching forward to prime the sublight drives and ready the subspace transceiver.
The star line sharpened to points of light, and the starfield rotated slightly. The ion drives flared to life with a deafening whoomp, and the ship began to lurch and hiccup. A distant object grew larger in the viewport, slowly defining itself as a linear array of geometric modules, linked by girdle-like structural members and transparent tubular passageways. Docking berths extended from every module, many of them housing ion cannons and turbo lasers in place of ships. Han relaxed into his chair.
A thing of beauty if I ever saw one.
Looks awfully beat up, Leia said dubiously. Han straightened somewhat.
Yeah, now that you mention it.
A blast rocked the Falcon from behind, snapping everyone back in their chairs. Kraken raised his eyes to the overhead viewport.
They couldn't have followed us through hyperspace. It can't be the same vessels.
Han veered the Falcon hard to port. A second before, 2 magma missiles raced past the ship's mandibles.
Somebody's changed the rules.
A molten projectile hit the Falcon broadside, and a wired-filled module dropped, sparking from the cockpit ceiling. Han barrel-rolled the ship, then dived abruptly. Han and Leia looked up at the same time to find themselves squared off with a Yuuzhan Vong battle group of capital vessels, gunboat analogs, tenders, and what was certainly a Yamask-bearing cluster ship.
You know, you have a real knack for this, Leia said.
It's not me, Han protested. The Navicomputer has itself convinced the trouble is the Falcon's default preference.
A likely story,
The quartet of curved-tailed, six-legged skips that had apparently chased the Falcon from Silvaris were directly below, spewing plasma missiles even as they jinked and juked to evade incessant laser bursts from the dorsal and belly AG-2Gs. Leia swiveled to the comm board. "Kalula Station, come in. Transmit our identification code," Han said. "Kalula Station, this is the Millennium Falcon. Please acknowledge."
"Millennium Falcon, this is Kalula Station. Someone should have told us you were coming."
Routing additional power to the main thrusters, Han firewalled the throttle and began to take the Falcon through a repertoire of stomach-churning evasive maneuvers. The tandem piloted skips did their best to keep up, singeing the Falcon's stern with gouts of plasma. But as the Falcon neared the station, the enemy vessels had to contend also with laser beams and the sting of ion cannons. "Don't worry," Leia assured Paige and Kraken as Han continued to rocket for the small window Kalula Station had opened. "Han does this all the time." The moment the Falcon soared into the station's embrace, the shield repowered. For all the world-shaping and geologic surgery performed on Coruscant, Westport, north of the former legislative district, remained a landing area. Royal Coral Craft had transported Shimra's retinue from the worldship Citadel, which rose to the east atop what had once been the Imperial District, to within a kilometer of Westport. Once back on the ground, the Supreme Overlord was conveyed the remaining distance by Royal Palanquin. The sky was a radiant purple, with the Rainbow Bridge faintly visible halfway to Apogee. But the flawless sky belied the melancholy nature of the procession, for all who formed it knew of the events that had transpired at Silvaris. The enemy had somehow learned of the Peace Brigade convoy and had ambushed it, recapturing many of the captives who were slated to be sacrificed at the imminent ceremony. Quick action on the part of a Yuuzhan Vong commander had resulted in the escape of three Peace Brigade freighters, which had communicated the convoy's distress to Yuuzhan Tar. A band of slayers had been dispatched and had performed brilliantly, much to the displeasure of many an elite warrior, who regarded the slayers as abominations to the caste system, and who fretted about the augmentative power they provided the Supreme Overlord. Noma Nor walked several paces behind the skull-adorned palanquin, in a group that included High Priest Jaqen, Master Shaper Keela Quad, War Master Nas Choka, High Prefect Drathul, and other elites. Noma Nor considered that Shimra might order the procession to trample the prostrate brigaders. But instead, the Supreme Overlord called a halt to the entourage when his palanquin had reached the center of the field. The mixed-species lot of already battered turncoats knew enough to remain face down on the rough ground, while High Priest Jaqen's acolytes, joined by Anami, circulated among them, anointing them with Palak incense and Venogel. Then Jaqen placed himself among their midst, his hooded eyes surveying the lumps and welts that slayers had administered to the brigaders before they had been shuttled down to Yuuzhan Tar. The High Priest moved on to the Yuuzhan Vong warriors and summoned their commander, Bu Fath. A towering warrior with inadequate skill for command, his escalation had come about only as a result of persistent petitioning by members of Domain Fath, which included several important consuls.
"How many captives did you deliver, Commander?"
Jaqen asked. Bu Fath pivoted slightly to salute War Master Nas Choka.
6 packets. Nearly 500.
Jaqen shook his head in disappointment and glanced up at Shimra.
"Less than half the minimal amount required for a ceremony of such magnitude."
Shimra gazed stonily from the hard bed of his palanquin, but said nothing. Even when the seers began to consult their divination biots and moan in distress, Nas Choka waited patiently before saying,
"A suggestion, great lord."
Shimra granted him a gaze.
"Proceed, War Master."
"We are presently engaged in a campaign to occupy a world known as Kalula. If you would permit our efforts to be doubled there, the planet will fall and many captives will be available to enrich our supply. Why not let the brave defenders of the orbital complex serve to compensate for our dearth of illustrious sacrifices?"
Shimra looked to Jaqen, then the seers, who nodded.
"Let it be done."
"The damage looks much worse from out here,"
C-3PO said, staring up at the belly of the Millennium Falcon from the foot of the landing ramp. Han glared at him from under the ship, where he, Leia, and a Kalula station mechanic were compiling a list of needed repairs.
Who asked you, 3PO?
The protocol droid adopted a posture of inquisitiveness.
No one, Captain Solo. I was only remarking.
3PO, Leia cut him off. That's enough for now.
Of course, Princess Leia. I know when I'm not wanted.
That'll be the day,
Han said.
Welcome aboard Kalula Station, Captain Solo.
Before Han could reply, a silver-haired human officer stepped in and saluted him.
Captain Solo, sir. I was with you at Endor.
Han thought for a moment.
Denev, right?
The man beamed.
I'm proud that you remember me, sir.
Likewise, Captain. Leia folded her arms across her chest and stared at Han. That's the 10th person who's recognized you. What is this? A gathering of your fan club? Han frowned at her. Very funny.
Captain Solo, someone said.
Walking briskly toward the Falcon was a portly but energetic human major general.
Base Commander Gary,
the man said, extending his hand to Han. Han shook hands and gestured to C-3PO and Leia.
Our droid and my wife, Leia Organa Solo.
Gary turned to his even more portly adjutant.
Chief, see that Captain Solo's passengers are treated for injuries and well-fed.
The adjutant saluted.
If you'll follow me, sirs,
he said to Kraken and the others. Han kept silent until everyone had moved off.
What's the situation here, Commander?
Gary tilted his head to one side. Take a walk with me and I'll explain. He led Han, Leia, and C-3PO on a slow tour of the docking bay. In the strobing light of arc welders, past technicians and soldiers who looked every bit as scarred and patched up as the ships they were working on.
The Yuuzhan Vong showed up about a month ago, Gary was saying, and it's been steady fighting ever since. Our defense platform is history, and for the past local week we've been under constant siege. But it's become clear that the Vong want to occupy Kalula rather than raise it, or they'd have dropped a moon on it or poisoned it like they've done elsewhere.
So what do the Yuuzhan Vong want with Kalula? Leia asked. Gary looked at her while they walked.
Captives.
They continued to walk and talk and bump into people who knew or recognized Han and Leia. Kalula seemed to have drawn every celebrated soldier, mercenary, and ne'er-do-well from within 1,000 parsecs. Commander Gary excused himself to attend a business, but promised he'd rendezvous with them in the mess hall. They were emerging from one of the transparent connectors that linked the station's separate modules when Han heard what he thought was a familiar voice. The source of the voice was a dark-haired man as old as himself, dressed in a worn gray flight suit that was cinched at the waist by a broad red belt. Of medium height but broad-chested, he was sitting cross-legged atop a cargo crate in a murky area of the module between a golden-furred Bothan and a tall Calibop, whose wings were folded behind him. Surrounding the trio stood roguish-looking human and alien warriors in similar gray flight suits.
Another fan? Leia asked.
Han rubbed his stubbled jaw. I definitely know the voice from somewhere, but I can't place the face. Instantly, the station was thrown into managed chaos. Everyone knew precisely where to report and what to do, except Han, Leia, and C-3PO, who weren't sure whether they should go to the nearest battle station or simply stay out of everyone's way. Appearing out of nowhere, Gary put a quick end to their confusion.
Enemy reinforcements have arrived. Another entire battle group.
Leia was astonished. They must be desperate to have Kalula to spare so many ships.
Gary agreed. Our shield should hold.
The commander's adjutant came running to report that the station's long-range scanners had zeroed in on something unusual. Gary led everyone to the nearest display screen, on which the adjutant called up a holocam view of what looked to be a colossal space slug, with a wedge-shaped head, a dorsal pouch, and a mouth that had to be 80 meters wide. Gary narrowed his eyes to slits.
What in the galaxy am I looking at?
Leia loosed a troubled exhalation. That, Commander, is what the Yuuzhan Vong call an Inca, the one they deployed at Duro, practically ate an orbital city.
The Inca led the attack on Kalula Station, towed in place by a special breed of Dovin Basil, grown on faraway Tyna. The monster slug fastened itself to Kalula's deflector shields like a leech. fattening as it absorbed every joule of ionized energy the generator could summon, then taking the suddenly vulnerable central module in its enormous mouth and crushing it like an eggshell. No sooner had the module depressurized than into the Wren dropped hundreds of Yuuzhan Vong warriors, disgorged from landing craft and outfitted with armor and the star-shaped breathing creatures known as Nulliths. Close to where the Inca was feasting, crouched behind a rampart of fuel-depleted loaders and stacked cargo crates, Han, Leia, and 24 soldiers waited with hand weapons, assault rifles, repeating blasters, and a few grenades and rockets that had been scrounged from Kalula's near-empty armory. 50 meters away, something was burning an enormous hole in the lowered blast shield. Han checked the charge of his DL-44 and drew a bead on the center of the circle.
"Hold your fire," he said. "Wait till they show themselves."
First through the breach were a pair of Gruchina. The 6-meter-long beasts leapt snarling from the acid clouds like apparitions, only to be cut to pieces by blaster fire before they had gone 10 meters. Then the armored warriors came, rushing through in groups of 3 and 4, hands gripped on amphistaffs or bandoliers of thudbugs.
"Now!"
Han shouted. 30 blasters fired simultaneously, dropping the vanguard dozen, then a dozen more behind them. But the Yuuzhan Vong kept coming, treading on their fallen comrades in a mad charge and hurling plasma eels and amphistaffs on the run. The weapons thumped against the barrier and caught one or two of the defenders by surprise. But no razor bugs or airborne venom followed, making clearer than ever that the warriors wanted captives, not casualties. Blasters fired nonstop, and the thrumming blade of Leia's lightsaber batted away a hail of thudbugs. But the line couldn't be held. Outnumbered, the defenders were forced to fall back. The Yuuzhan Vong pressed the attack, stopping only to drag away and bind those they had stunned. The warriors exulted at the taking of each captive, even though 6 of their number might have died to gain one victim. Withdrawing deeper into the station, Leia was glancing over her shoulder as she approached a corridor intersection, when Han suddenly threw his left arm around her waist and twirled her off to one side. From the scarlet glow of the intersecting corridor dropped an amphistaff, thick as a war club, slicing the air where she would have been and hitting the deck with a hollow thud. The warrior attached to the amphistaff howled and sprang forward, falling victim to a precisely placed bolt from Han's sidearm.
"This way, 3PO, hurry!"
Leia yelled. He glanced at her, then gestured to the side corridor.
"But, Princess!"
"Come on!" C-3PO muttered something, then began to shuffle forward as fast as his squeaking legs would carry him. Leia and Han were waiting for him at the next blast shield. She palmed the operating stud as soon as C-3PO had crossed the threshold, but the shield only closed halfway. Han pounded the stud with his fist, then, stepping back a meter, fired a bolt into the control panel. Leia ducked the ricochet and shook her head in dismay. "Anyone ever tell you you're as hard on technology as the Yuuzhan Vong?" The thick blast shield vibrated and slammed to the deck. Han grinned smugly. "Only when technology puts up an argument. And speaking of which, where'd 3PO go?" Taking a quick look around, Leia found him cowering in a corner. "What are you standing around for?" Han said. "You want to end up a skewer droid?"
"No, Captain Solo, but the blast door!"
His words were garbled by the sound of approaching footfalls. Leia raised her lightsaber, Han his blaster, but it was a dozen Alliance soldiers who showed up a moment later.
"You don't want to go that way,"
Han and one of the soldiers said at the same time. "Yuuzhan Vong," Han said, pointing toward the blast shield.
"Dead end,"
the soldier said, pointing in the opposite direction. Han stared at the blast shield, then whipped around.
"Dead end?"
A band of warriors surged down the corridor. 40 strong, they outnumbered the defenders better than 2-1. Fusillades of blaster fire improved the odds somewhat, but also depleted many of the weapons. Exhilarated by the sight of empty blasters being hurled aside, the warriors ordered their amphistaffs to curl about their forearms and began to strut forward, determined to go hand to hand with their quarries. Several of them had their sights set on Leia, who was parrying the last of the thudbugs with nimble twists of her lightsaber. Han broke for her side, shooting from the hip to drop 2 of Leia's would-be contenders. 2 others were quick to fill the gap. One lost his head to Leia's blade. The other flew straight at Han, driving him clear across the corridor and hard into the exterior bulkhead. Dodging hammer blows, Han slid down the wall and squirmed between the warrior's legs, hoping to be able to choke him from behind. But the warrior spun while Han was struggling to stand, vicing his huge hands around Han's neck in an Ast-Kor throat hold and whirling him back against the bulkhead. Han saw stars. Then darkness made a narrow tunnel of his vision. He was gasping for breath when the warrior's head suddenly exploded. The hands on Han's throat loosened, and the body crumpled to the deck, taking Han with it. His outstretched right hand seized on a small object, and he held it up to his eyes. As long as a human finger, and somewhat thicker, it was an older generation rocket dart, with its obviously defective explosive tip still attached. Han wriggled free of the fallen warrior in time to see four more Yuuzhan Vong felled from behind by blaster bolts and rocket darts. The fatal volley was coming from halfway down the corridor, where half a dozen soldiers were crouched, kneeling and prone on the deck. They wore pinch-cheeked helmets that were as domed as an R2 unit, bisected by horizontal viewplate strips and surmounted by flag-like targeting rangefinders. Their gray uniforms were exoskeleton by blast dissipation vests, forearm gauntlets, knee pads, armor mesh gloves, and alloy boots with zero-G grip soles. They were armed with blaster rifles, handguns, combat knives, rocket dart launchers, and whatever else might have been hiding in the alloy utility pouches affixed to their broad belts. A weapons system all his own, the leader wore a combination jetpack and anti-personnel missile launcher, and his belt was red. Catching sight of Han, the trooper tendered a distinctive fingertip salute before hurrying off.
Fett?
Han managed.
Fett?
Leia shook her head in refusal. It can't be him. Anyone could be inside that armor. Han nodded his head in agreement.
That's gotta be it. Besides, I mean, even if it is him, he was probably trying to kill me, not save me.
Han, Leia, C-3PO, and the surviving Kalula soldiers stepped over the bodies of the Yuuzhan Vong and raced after the troops in Mandalorian armor, who had already moved off.